humanitarian intervention is a mere euphemism. When we advocate humanitarian intervention, we are advocating war. I think it's a bit of a rewriting of history to say that humanitarian intervention was not a significant factor in the arguments for war in Iraq or Afghanistan. They were very much part of that, both those wars. And I would say the results very much discredit the idea of humanitarian intervention.
That's David Gibbs, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features David Gibbs and Michael Chertoff in a debate on humanitarian intervention. Humanitarian intervention is always cloaked in altruism. Noted author Noam Chomsky says, almost every aggressive act by any great power is justified on humanitarian grounds. Helping people who are suffering is laudable, but injecting military force can lead to even worse outcomes. Libya is a perfect example of what can go wrong. The specter of atrocities was raised. A U.S., U.K., France, and Canada bombing campaign ensued. The attacks destroyed most of Libya's infrastructure and killed thousands, leaving the country, Chomsky says, in the hands of warring militias. In addition, there's been a flow of arms and jihadis into West Africa and the Middle East, which has become the major source of radical terrorism in the world, largely a consequence of so-called humanitarian intervention in Libya. We should be very leery when this doctrine is invoked as justification for intervention. Our guests today are Michael Chertoff and David Gibbs. Michael Chertoff was former Secretary of Homeland Security during the presidency of George W. Bush and co-author of the USA Patriot Act. David Gibbs is professor of history at the University of Arizona. He has published widely on international affairs. He's the author of First Do No Harm. The debate took place at the Oxford Union Society at Oxford University in Great Britain in March 2019. Professor David Gibbs begins the debate.
Well, I think when one looks at humanitarian intervention, one has to look at the record of what has actually happened. And in particular, the last three major interventions since 2000, Iraqi intervention of 2003, the Afghanistan intervention of 2001, and the Libya intervention of 2011. And what all three of these have in common is that all three were justified, at least in part, on humanitarian grounds. I mean, the first two partly, the third almost exclusively, were justified on humanitarian grounds. And all three produced humanitarian disasters. This is really quite clear, I think, to anybody who has been reading the newspaper, that these interventions have not gone well at all. And when evaluating the larger issue of humanitarian intervention, one really has to first look at those basic facts, which are not pleasant. It's very surprising to me in a lot of ways. The whole concept of humanitarian intervention wasn't just fully discredited by those experiences, but it is not. We still have calls for other interventions, including in Syria, most notably also there are frequent calls for regime change, essentially intervention in North Korea. I will hazard two predictions. One, it almost certainly will be justified, at least in part, as a humanitarian intervention designed to liberate the people of North Korea from a very unwholesome dictator. And two, it'll produce probably the biggest humanitarian disaster since 1945. One of the questions is, why are we not learning from our mistakes? The scale of the failures in these three previous interventions is, in a lot of ways, quite impressive. With regard to Iraq, it's perhaps the best documented failure, I would say. We have the 2006 Lancet study, epidemiologically looking at excess deaths in Iraq, which at that time estimated 560,000 excess deaths. This was published in 2006, so presumably it's much higher by now. There have been other estimates, mostly on par with that one. And, this is something that is problematic. Certainly things are terrible under Saddam Hussein. That's indisputable, as they were under the Taliban, as they were under Muammar Gaddafi, as they currently are under Kim Jong-un in North Korea. And so we went in and removed from power those three figures one by one, or I should say in the Taliban, a larger regime, Mullah Omar, leading a larger regime. And things promptly got worse. It didn't seem to have occurred to policymakers that things could actually get worse, but they did. Another effect that's worth noting is what I would say is a kind of destabilization of regions. This is particularly striking in the case of Libya, which destabilized much of North Africa, triggering a secondary civil war in Mali in 2013, which was directly attributable to the destabilization of Libya. This required a secondary intervention by France this time to combat basically the instability arising in that country, again justified at least in part on humanitarian grounds. One of the things one can say in terms of the effects of humanitarian intervention is that if you are a vested interest in intervention, and that is something you are seeking, it's an excellent idea because it's the gift that just keeps on giving. It keeps on destabilizing regions, producing new humanitarian crises, thus justifying new interventions. That's certainly what happened in the case of Libya and then Mali. Now, if you're interested in humanitarian effect, however, the situation does not look so good and does not look very positive at all. A very striking thing here is the loss of credibility. I'm very struck by the fact that the people who helped to argue for these three interventions, and by that I don't just mean policymakers, but also academics and intellectuals like myself. I myself didn't argue for them, but many of my colleagues did. And it's rather remarkable to me that there's no expression of regret or acknowledgement they did anything wrong in arguing for these interventions, nor is their effort again to learn from our mistakes and to try and avoid interventions in the future. There's something very dysfunctional about the character of discussion on this topic, where we fail to learn from past mistakes. A second problem with the issue of humanitarian intervention is what some have called the dirty hands problem. We are relying on countries and agencies of those countries which do not have very good records of humanitarian activity. Let us look at the United States and its history of interventionism. If one looks at that, the history of U.S. interventionism, we find the United States as an intervening power was a major cause of humanitarian crises in the past. If one looks, for example, at the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, the overthrow of Allende in Chile in 1973, and I think most striking example, less known one, is Indonesia in 1965, where the CIA helped engineer a coup and then helped orchestrate a massacre of people that led to about 500,000 deaths. It's one of the really great massacres post-1945. Yes, indeed, on the scale of what happened in Rwanda, at least approximately. And that was something caused by intervention. And, you know, an obvious question, one could also go into the issue of the Vietnam War and look, for example, at the Pentagon Papers, the secret Pentagon study of the Vietnam War. And one does not get a sense of the United States as either a gentle power or a particularly humanitarian one, and the effects certainly were not humanitarian in any of these cases. There's the larger issue, perhaps, of human rights violations by the agencies of state that are involved in intervention in the United States. We now know from declassified documents that both the uniformed military and the CIA were responsible in the 50s and early 60s in conducting radiation experiments on unsuspecting individuals, doing things like going around and having doctors working for the military, injecting people with radioactive isotopes, and then tracking their bodies over time to see what effects it had and what kind of illnesses it caused them, without telling them, of course. The CIA had very disturbing mind control experiments, testing new interrogation techniques on unsuspecting individuals with very damaging effects. One of the scientists involved in the radiation studies commented in private, again this is from a declassified document, that some of what he was doing had what he called the Buchenwald effect. And one could see what he meant. And the obvious question again is, why on earth would we want to trust agencies that do things like this to do something humanitarian now? Now, this is of course long ago, but the fact that we now use the term humanitarian intervention does not make it a magical phrase and does not magically erase this past history, which is relevant and has to be taken into account. I do not want to focus excessively on my own country. After all, other states have done other disturbing things. One can look at the history of Britain and France, let us say, with colonial and post-colonial interventions. One does not get a picture of humanitarian activity, quite the contrary, I would say, either in intent or in effect. Now, I think one of the issues that finally has to be noted is the cost of humanitarian intervention. This is something that is rarely taken into account, but perhaps should be taken into account, especially since the record of results is so bad in terms of humanitarian effect. Well, military action, generally speaking, is extremely expensive. Amassing division-sized forces, deploying them overseas for extended periods of time, cannot be done except at extreme expense. In the case of the Iraq War, what we have is what has been termed the $3 trillion war. Joseph Stiglitz of Columbia and Linda Bilmes estimated in 2008 the long-term cost of the Iraq War at $3 trillion. Those figures, of course, are obsolete because that's over 10 years ago, but $3 trillion is quite a lot when you think about it. In fact, it's greater than the combined gross domestic product of Great Britain at the present time. And one wonders what kind of wonderful humanitarian projects we could have done with $3 trillion rather than wasting it in a war that did nothing but kill several hundred thousand people and destabilized a region. And these wars are not over, of course, in either Libya nor Iraq and nor Afghanistan. Afghanistan is nearing the end of its second decade of war and in the second decade of U.S. intervention. One can think of all sorts of things that could have been done with some of this money. For example, vaccination of children who are under-vaccinated. One could think of people who don't have enough medicines, including in my own country, the United States, where many people would go without proper medicines. You cannot, as economists know, you have opportunity cost. If you spend money on one thing, you may not have it available for another. And I think what we've been doing is overspending on intervention, again, with no significant humanitarian results, or very few that I can discern. I guess I'm very impressed by the medical analogy here and the medical emphasis. And that's, of course, I've titled my book, First Do No Harm. And the reason is that in medicine, you don't just go and operate on the patient because the patient is suffering. You have to do a proper analysis of whether or not the operation will be positive or negative. An operation can, of course, hurt people. And in medicine, sometimes the best thing to do is nothing. And perhaps here, the first thing we should do with the humanitarian crises is not make them worse, which is what we've done. Thank you.
Well, so the proposition here is whether humanitarian intervention is a contradiction in terms. And I think the answer to that is no. Sometimes it's ill-advised, sometimes it's well-advised. Sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it does work. It rarely works perfectly, but nothing in life does. So let me first begin by talking about the three examples the professor gave, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. I'm going to tell you Afghanistan was not a humanitarian intervention. Afghanistan was the result of an attack launched on the United States that killed 3,000 people, and it was quite openly and deliberately an effort to remove the person who launched the attack from the ability to do it again. If you think it wasn't worth it, I will tell you from personal experience, when we went into Afghanistan, we found laboratories Al-Qaeda was using to experiment with chemical and biological agents on animals so they could deploy those against people in the West. Had we not gone into Afghanistan, we might be inhaling those now as we speak. This is not humanitarian in the sense of altruistic. This is kind of basic core security that every country owes its citizens. Iraq is also, I think, in my view, not principally a humanitarian intervention. We can debate in a different debate what happened with the intelligence and whether it was totally wrong or only partially wrong regarding the possibility of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But at least that was the major assumption going in. It may have been erroneous, and there are all kinds of arguments that the way in which it was executed was poorly done. But again, it was not humanitarian. Libya was a humanitarian intervention, and the problem with Libya is, I think, the second part of what I want to say, which is not all humanitarian interventions are good, and in order to make a decision to intervene, you have to take into account some very important elements of what you're facing. What is your strategy and your objective? Do you have clarity about that? What is your awareness of what the conditions in the place you're intervening in actually are? What are your capabilities and your willingness to be committed to see things through to the end? And then to what degree do you have support from the international community? Libya is an example of a case where, while the impulse may have been humanitarian, these things were not carefully thought out. And if I can say so, Michael Hayden and I made this point in an op-ed shortly after this process began, that the easy part was going to be removing Gaddafi. The hard part was going to be what happens after Gaddafi is removed. And so here I agree with the professor. Had someone looked at the four factors I mentioned, they would have said, well, we don't really know, we haven't really thought through what happens without Gaddafi, what happens to all the extremists in prison, what happens to all the mercenaries that he's paid for who now aren't getting paid anymore. And that led to some of the negative results. I also think there was a failure to understand that when you remove a dictator, you have an unstable situation. And as Colin Powell used to say, if you broke it, you bought it. If you're going to remove a dictator, you've got to then be prepared to invest in stabilizing. If you're not prepared to make that investment, you have no business removing him. By way of example, on the other side, if you look at, for example, the interventions in Sierra Leone and Ivory Coast, Sierra Leone was 2000. There was the United Front was advancing on the capital. The British came in, they repelled them, they drove them back. And because of that, Sierra Leone was able to stabilize and they ultimately wound up having elections. Or Ivory Coast, you had an incumbent who refused to accept that he had lost an election. He began to use violence against his people. There was an intervention. He was ultimately arrested. And now Ivory Coast has a democracy. So again, there are ways to do a humanitarian intervention that can be successful, but not if you don't pay attention to the four characteristics I talked about. Now let me give you an example from something that we are literally facing today, and that is what is going on in Syria. And let's ask the question whether a couple of years ago, before the Russians got deeply involved, before the Iranians got deeply involved, whether an intervention would have made a difference in saving literally tens of thousands of people from being killed, innocent civilians with bombs and chemical weapons, as well as a huge mass migration crisis. And I think the answer is, had we done in Syria what we did in northern Iraq in 1991, established a no-fly zone and a no-go zone for Assad and his people, and if we had done it early, we might have averted what we now see unfolding, continuing to unfold in the region. So I'm going to now look at it from the other lens. What happens when you don't intervene, as I suggested we might have done in Syria? Well, not only do you have a humanitarian crisis, you have a security crisis. Because as a consequence of not really enforcing any of the rules I've talked about, and notwithstanding the fact that President Obama said there was a red line about chemical weapons, and then the line disappeared when the chemical weapons were used, because of the fact that we didn't enforce these humanitarian measures, we had not only many deaths, but we literally had an upheaval that has now reached into the heart of Europe. The reason the EU is now having a crisis about migration is because, and perhaps with some intent, the Russians, as well as the Syrians, deliberately acted to drive civilians out of the country and force them to go elsewhere. Many of them now in Jordan and putting a strain on Jordan, but many of them trying to get into Europe. And I have little doubt that Putin understood or quickly recognized, even if it was not his original intent, that once you create a migration crisis, you are creating a disorder and dissension within your principal adversary, which is Europe, and that has a destabilizing effect, the consequences of which we continue to see today. And so one of the things I want to say, to be honest, is when we talk about humanitarian intervention, there is often an altruistic dimension to it. But frankly, there is also a self-interested dimension. Places of disorder are places where terrorists operate, and you've seen ISIS, until quite recently, had territory in parts of Syria and parts of Iraq that were not properly governed. It creates migration crises and similar crises, which then have an impact on the stability and the good order of the rest of the world. And it also creates grievances and desires for payback that often result in cycles of violence that continue over and over again, and you see that in Rwanda. My bottom line is this. Not all humanitarian interventions are warranted. Not all humanitarian interventions are properly thought out and properly executed, but by the same token, not all of them are wrong or improperly executed. And again, I'll go back to 1991 and the no-fly zone and no-go zone in Kurdistan as an example of one that worked. The key is this. Be clear why you're going in. Don't underestimate the cost of what you're undertaking. Have the capabilities and the commitment to see that you can handle those costs and achieve the result that you set out for yourself. make sure you are aware of the conditions on the ground so you make a rational assessment. And finally, get international support. Don't go it alone. I think in those circumstances, humanitarian intervention can not only be successful, but it can save a lot of lives and make our world more secure. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And thank you both for those introductory remarks. So I'll ask one question and then we'll move over to questions from the audience. And my question is this. You both cited a number of historical examples, but would you say it's a fair assessment that practically the problem is that there can never be a sufficient long-term plan, sufficient well intentions, sufficient benevolent motivations, or a sufficient harm analysis to counter the fact that individual organisations and international organisations are fallible and they will always make mistakes? And it is the fallibility of those groups that means humanitarian intervention has to be a contradiction in terms. So, Michael, if you'd like to respond.
Well, my answer is this. Inaction is action. Some people think if you don't do something, that's somehow abstaining. But if you don't do something, something is going to happen. So if, for example, Franklin Roosevelt had decided not to help the British in 1940 with the Lend-Lease, because I don't know if I'm making a mistake or not, and that had resulted in a different outcome with respect to World War II, I don't think we'd be saying, well, but that was inaction, so it didn't matter. I think inaction is a form of action, and every time you're presented with a choice, you have to balance the consequences, as far as you can project them, from both doing something and abstaining from doing something.
Well, I think that, of course, inaction is a form of action, but the onus should always be on the person advocating intervention. Because let's be very clear on this. Intervention is an act of war. Humanitarian intervention is a mere euphemism. When we advocate humanitarian intervention, we are advocating war. The movement for intervention is a movement for war. And it seems to me those who advocate against war really have no burden on them of proof. The burden of proof should be on those who advocate for the use of violence. And really, the standard should be very high for the use of violence. And I think we can see it's been used quite frivolously in the past to an extraordinary degree. And a basic problem you do have in small interventions, for example, the 1991 no-fly zone over Iraq, is these things take place in the real world, not in a pretend world. And in that real world, the United States considers itself a great power, and there will always be the question of American credibility. And if the U.S. undertakes half measures, such as a no-fly zone, there will always be pressures on the United States from various factions of the foreign policy establishment to take a more maximalist effort and solve the problem once and for all, hence the need for another war with Iraq in 2003, producing an utter catastrophe. I get very queasy when I hear people discussing, let us just do a limited intervention, it'll just stop at that, because it usually doesn't stop at that. There's the quagmire effect. You step in the quagmire and you get deeper and deeper into the quagmire. And there'll always be those who advocate deeper and deeper intervention. I guess one more point I did want to respond to the claim, which is a frequent one, that the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were not really humanitarian interventions. It is true that this was, to some extent, both interventions were at least partly traditional national interest, realpolitik and the like. But if you look back at the record, clearly both were justified in part as humanitarian interventions, both by the Bush administration as well as many academics. I have here before me an edited volume published by the University of California Press in, I believe it's 2005, called A Matter of Principle, Humanitarian Arguments for War in Iraq. Just do a Google search on humanitarian arguments for war in Iraq. And this was very much part of the picture. I think it's a bit of a rewriting of history to say that humanitarian intervention was not a significant factor in the arguments for war in Iraq or Afghanistan. They were very much part of that, both those wars. And I would say the results very much discredit the idea of humanitarian intervention.
Thank you. Yep, so we'll go to the hand in the back.
What do you think about sort of the statement that humanitarian interventions kind of work when a sovereign nation is attacking another sovereign nation? Because with the breakup of Yugoslavia, a lot of people see the intervention there as successful, or Saddam's invasion with Kuwait and the West supporting Kuwait and liberating it. Those were seen as successful, whereas things like Syria, if we had gone in, could have been a disaster. Iraq and Afghanistan weren't having a civil war, but they were a nation within themselves which didn't have, in our view, a favorable regime. Same with Syria. And that's why Iraq and Afghanistan for many people are seen as complete and utter failures and a waste of time and trillions wasted, hundreds of thousands of lives lost for nothing.
Right. I think that there is widespread perception the interventions in the former Yugoslavia, notably Bosnia and Herzegovina in 95 and in Kosovo in 1999, were examples of successful humanitarian interventions. For what it's worth, much of my career has been attempting to refute that. The book I've written on the topic was largely a claim that these were not successful humanitarian interventions. I believe the record shows of the declassified documents we have available to us at this time that there's a high likelihood that both of these conflicts could have been settled much earlier. In the case of Bosnia, probably this conflict might never have even started. I think that the problem you have here is that the whole rhetoric of humanitarian intervention is so much presented as a moral crusade that a negotiated settlement or any compromise settlement is seen as a sellout, a moral failure, and international forces that try and broker a compromise settlement are modern-day versions of Neville Chamberlain. And as a result, basically, you can get years of warfare, and this is exactly what happened in Bosnia and Kosovo. In the case of Bosnia, there was an agreement among the three constituent ethnic groups of Bosnia, the Muslims, the Serbs, and the Croats, brokered by the United European Community, it was called at that time, in Lisbon, under a Portuguese diplomat named José Coutinho. And all three of them signed the agreement, and signed, I should say, a preliminary version of the agreement. It was not a completed agreement as yet. And this took place in a context where already there was a tremendous press buildup condemning Serb atrocities, and rightly so up to a point, but nevertheless taking on a tone of military intervention as necessary to solve this problem. And anything but military intervention would be seen as a sellout. And I think partly if influenced by that, the U.S. ambassador to Yugoslavia, Warren Zimmerman, contacted the president of Bosnia-Herzegovina, a Muslim, and urged him to renege on his agreement, which he did, leading to the collapse of the agreement and the onset of war. A CIA report that was published said that as late as April, a month later, the Serbs were still open to a compromise settlement. But the United States seemed to be emphasizing more a military settlement. And the result was 3 years of war with horrible atrocities and over 100,000 deaths. I think the record suggests that this probably could have been avoided. If you read, for example, the memoirs of David Owen, the former British Foreign Secretary, who then tried to revive some version of the Lisbon Agreement over the next 2.5 years, he notes that one of the main problems that prevented him from doing so was that the United States never really accepted the idea of a compromise settlement and seemed to be taking the view that a military solution was necessary. Now, that sounds very moral, except when you realize it resulted in tens of thousands of deaths that might not have been necessary. I think a very similar scenario played out in Kosovo as well. As far as Syria goes, I think we have, there's a question of what some political scientists have called moral hazard, whereby you get a situation, again, where rebels are encouraged to rebel on the assumption that they will get external support of the sort we eventually did in, for example, Kosovo or Libya just before the Syrian intervention. And Alan Cooperman at the University of Texas has commented that he's written about how the Syrian rebels did seem to be rebelling on the assumption and resorting to violent means to overthrow the Assad regime, partly on the assumption that it would elicit military support from the U.S. and its allies, some form of humanitarian intervention. And the problem with that is, just look at Syria now, hundreds of thousands of deaths later, and what has it accomplished? Nothing. Perhaps it would have been better if we had never encouraged the Syrian rebels in the first place, when the United States was not prepared to undertake a real full intervention. And let us say, hypothetically, the United States did do a full intervention, sent in 100,000 troops, as the United States did in Iraq, and decisively defeated the Assad dictatorship. Well, we could have another Iraq on our hands, and maybe another $3 trillion war, another Iraq-style disaster. So it seems to me, perhaps in these types of wars, very often the best thing to do is, if you can, achieve a negotiated settlement, and if not, basically do nothing. Because again, nothing can often be better than the alternative, which can be much worse.
Thank you.
Of course, nothing can also be worse, depending on what, and that's part of the challenge here. In retrospect, it's always possible to say, oh, it would have been better to do something, plan B, but when you're living it, you don't have a guide like that.
You're listening to Michael Chertoff and before him, David Gibbs, in a debate on humanitarian intervention. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
I'll go back to Afghanistan, which I would insist to you was not really about humanitarianism, although understandably people said the Taliban are bad people, so if we can remove them, that's a better thing for Afghanistan. But this was very simply, you had a platform that had been used to kill Americans. The people who were getting safe haven there continued to say, we're going to do it again and again. The Taliban embraced him and did not kick him out. That is what we call self-defense. And that is what every country has a right to do. And as I've indicated, at the end of the day, we did find the laboratories, the training camps, and all the other paraphernalia that allowed al-Qaeda to carry out its attack on 9/11. I don't know that the distinction between dealing with an external invasion as opposed to an internal issue. I understand there is a difference, and there's some differences from the standpoint of international law. But in terms of the efficacy of what we do, I think it's a little more complicated than that. And Kuwait's an interesting example back in 1991. From an international law standpoint, it was clearly authorized for the United States to come to the aid of Kuwait to repel an invader who had crossed the sovereign border. There was a humanitarian element to that, too, because the Iraqis went in, they were pulling babies out of maternity wards and off of incubators, and they were really oppressing the population. So there was a humanitarian dimension as well. But here's an example where we may have actually slightly miscalculated by being too quick to settle and to stop. At the point at which we called a halt to military operations, once the Iraqis had been pushed across the border, that stopped the commanding general from being able to finish the process of encircling the Republican Guard and basically destroying it, which would have eliminated the major military force that Saddam Hussein had. And so it was just a matter of a few months later that that Republican Guard then went in to oppress the Kurds, and that's what caused the need for the second intervention with a no-fly zone. And by the way, just to explain why there was a real concern about what he had done with the Kurds, he did actually use chemical weapons in 1988 against the Kurds. So, and that is a clear red line, and both from a legal and a humanitarian standpoint. If you look at Syria, and again, I'm not going to debate the fact that these are not easy answers and that there are complicated calculuses that have to be undertaken. Sometimes, and I think the professor is right, you've got to be careful not to be encouraging people to think you're going to come to their aid if you're not going to do it. And one of the criticisms about President Obama's red line was it looked as if the U.S. was prepared to do something, and then in the event, the U.S. said, oh, you know, guess what? We've decided it's not really a red line after all. And that does run the risk of encouraging people to rise up or to take action with a mistaken belief that we have their backs. So you have to calibrate at all levels of what you do. Sometimes you run the risk of saying or doing too much. Sometimes you run the risk of saying and doing too little. But I'll come back to my original point. If we had, at the point at which the country started to become unstable and outsiders started to get involved in the process, particularly targeting civilians, if we had intervened with UN support to have safe havens and no-fly zones, we could have significantly reduced the amount of civilian deaths that came out of and continue to come out of the war in Syria. That would not only have been a good humanitarian thing, but it would have significantly reduced the risk of the migration crisis, which gave Putin his ability to finally start to disrupt the cohesiveness of Europe and the European alliance. So my answer is, I want to be quite clear, and I know the commentators after the fact always have their vision of what they're doing, you know, the people who write in articles. But when you're actually making the decision, and I've been there and been involved in making decisions, it's never 100% clear. You've got to weigh these factors And you've got to balance them. And you've got to recognize, as the professor says, sometimes you can't achieve 100% of your goal. So a reasonable compromise that stabilizes things may be the best you can get. That is the messy real world in which we continue to live.
I was wondering what your respective definitions of humanitarian intervention were. Does the claim to save lives warrant calling something a humanitarian intervention? Or does an underlying political motivation mean that an intervention cannot be called humanitarian? Is humanitarian intervention a mere slogan to justify something that would happen anyways? And most importantly, what implications does this definition have for justifying humanitarian interventions and for the question that we have today, namely, is it a contradiction in terms?
Thank you very much. Michael, if you'd like to start.
That's a very good question. So I think saving life is a humanitarian basis to intervene. Saving life and also, you know, preventing human slavery. I mean, if you were to have a regime that started to enslave people or turn women into sex slaves, I mean, I think that would qualify as humanitarian. I do not believe that changing a political system because you don't like the existing political system is a humanitarian intervention. And again, I recognize in the real world there are often mixed motives, and it's likely to be the case that regimes practicing mass murder and genocide are likely not to be particularly democratic. But to me, if you look at what's going on in Burma now with the Rohingya, or if you look at what happened in Sudan, where you have real loss of civilian innocent life, I think that qualifies as a humanitarian crisis. And then the decision to go in or not depends on the factors I've outlined. Whereas I do think that I think you can promote democracy in terms of advocacy, in terms of education, in terms of things of that sort. But I don't think that promoting democracy is by itself sufficiently compelling to actually go to war.
Well, I think that there are multiple definitions academics give for humanitarian intervention, but I think you touch on the issue of motive here. You know, I suppose I would see it for the most part as a cover for self-interested motives in virtually all cases. A particularly striking case was Libya, which many presented as an almost pure case of humanitarian intervention, where there was no self-interest on the part of the intervening parties. We now have actually a post-mortem report by the House of Commons, the British House of Commons. It's actually quite good and, in fact, very hard-hitting. Libya examination of intervention and collapse and the UK's future policy options. It had some leaked documents pertaining to the motives of Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, who played a leading role in the intervention, who, of course, cited exclusively humanitarian motives in public. In private, apparently, he was extolling the importance of the intervention to project French influence into North Africa and also to enable French oil companies to gain access to Libyan oil at the expense of Italian oil companies that had traditionally been dominant. To that, I might add, by the way, if you read the military press, there was a great effort by France, also by Britain, to showcase fighter planes. The Rafale fighter plane was very much emphasized as its combat role to ensure sales, to prove that it had been combat tested. This was a really very cynical affair. I think the cynicism of it is underscored by the fact that only a couple of years before, France had been trying to sell Muammar Gaddafi the Rafale fighter plane. So obviously they weren't all that offended by his oppression, his torture of his own people and the like, as the United States wasn't all that offended. After all, Gaddafi had been participating in an extraordinary rendition where the United States wanted to torture people and wanted to go beyond mere simulated drowning, waterboarding, as we'd called it in the United States, wanted to inflict really punishing torture. The United States would often ship them to Libya and have Gaddafi do it for us. Now, all of this basically suggests something other than humanitarian motive and suggests that the humanitarian motive was largely a pretext, which I think it was. I think an even additional motive for the United States, a critical one, is often finding a new justification for NATO. If you look at Kosovo, for example, the intervention in Kosovo, I suspect coming up with a new justification for NATO was probably the principal objective. And so the way I would look at this is it's very difficult to take a serious look at the recent humanitarian interventions and conclude they were humanitarian in anything other than a nice-sounding phrase, and that the real objective was much more traditional conceptions of national interest, as well as, in some case, cases, even more dubious things like selling weapons and so on, showcasing one's fighter planes. One should not underestimate the significance, by the way, of personal enrichment as a motive for interventionist impulse. I found there's a remarkable study by three economists in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, probably the leading journal in the economics field, or one of the leading ones, that basically showed most of the major CIA covert operations during the Cold War involved personal enrichment by people who were involved in the operation. I'd strongly recommend people look at the article, which is called Coups, Corporations, and Classified Information. It's at the NBER website. And again, all of this makes it very difficult to take seriously the idea of a genuinely humanitarian motive for the use of violence.
You mentioned that oftentimes humanitarian aid is used to justify national interest interventions based on national interest. So in the case of what's occurring in Myanmar right now, even though the UN has labeled the genocide on the Rohingya as a crime against humanity, do you think that the reason that the US has yet to intervene is because it doesn't further our political or economic interests?
The problem we do have, again, is a kind of crusading atmosphere. And the crusading atmosphere states that whenever the word... There was an editorial in the New Republic that said specifically, whenever genocide appears, military force should not be considered a last resort, but a first resort. Now, I have to say, I'm very troubled by what I see as an overuse of the term genocide in ways that I think are very different from the way it was used before 1990. I agree with William Shabas, the former president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars, that both academics, as well as to some extent the international courts, have been using this phrase a little bit frivolously to reflect things that are authentic atrocities and massacres, but really don't rise to the level of genocide unless you basically want to redefine genocide as meaning almost any kind of massacre, or in some cases, among some academics, it's being used as well to define some non-fatal forms of atrocities as well. Now, if you basically take that new definition of genocide and define it very broadly, as I believe it's been done, not somewhat narrowly as it was done, say, before 1990. And then you also take the proposition, as the New Republic said, that in time of genocide we must use military force. That's a recipe for virtually unlimited interventions around the world. In the case of Myanmar, I suppose the only thing I can think of is that it's over 50 million people, roughly twice the size of Iraq at the time of the U.S. invasion. And so, if Iraq basically was a disaster, one wonders if an intervention in Burma, Myanmar, would produce a disaster at twice the size. I would hate to think about it.
First of all, I do think what's going on there, whether you want to characterize it as a genocide or just, crimes against humanity, what they're doing to the Rohingya is obviously a serious humanitarian problem. I think realistically, there's an allergy in the U.S. now to, after Iraq, to getting involved in any kind of military activity. And we saw that not only under the current administration, we saw it under the Obama administration as it comes to Syria. Depending upon the exact conditions on the ground, again, having a no-go or a no-fly area might be something that would save lives and would minimize some of what's been going on. But I think realistically, as I say, there's a kind of a reaction in the other direction because of the war in Iraq. And also what I can't tell you, because I haven't studied it, is what the practical ability is to meet the conditions that I've said you need to evaluate before you go in. Do we have a clear sense of what the end game is? Do we have the capabilities to get there? Do we have international support? So, again, I guess my mantra over and over here is sometimes humanitarian interventions work, but sometimes they don't. And that's where you have to make a case-by-case analysis.
Thanks. So you've both talked about some historical examples, and I'd like to hear both of your perspectives about the ongoing situation in Venezuela and the Trump administration and the plans, and the reports have come out that they might have plans to use military force there, and how you would evaluate that in light of both of the perspectives that you've shared.
So I think what's happening in Venezuela is, first of all, I mean, there's obviously a political dictatorship. And as I've said, I don't think political regime issues are a reason to intervene militarily. There is also a humanitarian element here. People are starving. But I don't know that we're at the level of humanitarian crisis that we've seen in other cases. So my short answer would be, I don't think we've met the threshold for having a real discussion about humanitarian intervention in a military sense. That's not to say there aren't non-military ways to intervene. And just to be clear, so we round the picture out, there are a lot of tools in the toolbox when you deal with intervention. There are sanctions, economic sanctions. There is there even potential use of cyber tools as a way of having some impact on what's going on. There is the possibility in some instances of legal action, for example, international court of criminal court or something. So all of these ought to be considered part of the toolbox. If I was looking at Venezuela, assuming it did, which I emphasize it does not, reach the level of humanitarian intervention, you would then have to balance issues like is there an end game we see or a strategy we see that can be successful? Do we have the capabilities to achieve it? Do we have international support? I think all of those would probably militate against it. That's not to say it couldn't change, but the dimensions of this I don't think have reached the point where military action is reasonable or likely.
Well, the most important thing you need to know about Venezuela is that it's an undiversified oil exporting economy, and there's been a drop in oil prices since 2014. I'll certainly grant that a lot of what is going on now is the fault of Maduro and authoritarian actions he's been taking, as well as mismanagement, corruption, and so on. Most of what has been going on, by any reasonable read, by any informed reading, is due to low oil prices. It points to, I think, a larger issue, which is the way humanitarian crises are often triggered by economic crises. Discussions of Rwanda almost never discuss the fact that the genocide, and I think it really was a genocide in the case of Rwanda, the genocide of the Hutu, by the Hutu against the Tutsi, took place in the context of a major economic crisis resulting from a collapse of coffee prices. Again, a very undiversified economy that was reliant almost exclusively on coffee. Coffee prices collapse, you get a political crisis. Yugoslavia had a major economic crisis just before the country broke up and descended into hell. As we know about the descent into hell, most people don't know about the economic crisis. For some reason, people find economics boring, and because it's boring, and sort of military intervention seems more exciting, we think that the solution is to send in the 82nd Airborne Division, whereas perhaps it would have been simpler and a lot cheaper and easier and better from a humanitarian standpoint to address the economic crisis. The very heavy emphasis placed on austerity in the international economic system and the very damaging political effects austerity has in many countries. Historical context is necessary here for all the constant repetitious references to the Third Reich and to World War II, which we hear again and again and again and again. People often forget that one of the things that brought us Adolf Hitler was the Great Depression. If you had not had any reasonable reading of Weimar Germany's history, it would be that without the Depression, you almost certainly would not have gotten the rise of Nazism. And so I think a greater addressing of the economic issues in the case of Venezuela, even if the United States were to overthrow Maduro through whatever means and replace him with someone else, that someone else would still have to deal with the issue of low oil prices and the damaging effects on the economy, which would remain unaddressed by humanitarian intervention, whether we call it that or something else. I guess another point about the United States and Venezuela is the United Nations sent a representative down there and condemned the U.S. sanctions as greatly intensifying the humanitarian crisis. So the intervention the United States has been doing, economic at this point mostly, rather than military, is making things worse. And that clearly has to stop. If we're interested in helping the people of Venezuela, surely the United States would not want to make it worse.
Humanitarian crises often involve a conflict, as you mentioned, between issues including state sovereignty, state defense, and then the human rights issues within the states themselves. Now, even within the US Charter, there's this conflict between the right to use force if there's a threat to the peace or if there's use of aggression, and then the inherent right of state sovereignty and other states' use of basically non-intervention in other matters. Now, given then this conflict between specifically the three areas of state sovereignty, the rights of other states for their own self-defense, and human rights issues at the heart of this problem of humanitarian crises, do states have a right to intervene to protect human lives, or should the onus always be on there being a sufficient need for states to then demand external support?
Well, in an imaginary world, the answer would be yes. In an imaginary world, if you could, let us say, have a state that is genuinely disinterested, capable of intervening, and where we had reasonable certainty the intervention would have a positive effect, and facing, let us say, a major humanitarian crisis where a government is oppressing its people in extraordinary ways, let us say, in that imaginary world, I would say humanitarian intervention would be a great idea. But let us not forget we live in the real world. And in the real world, those factors simply don't apply at all. We do not have a state, any state, that's really disinterested. Again, we have to look at the record here of American interventionism. Would you really want to basically say, if you read the Pentagon Papers' account of the Vietnam War and the extraordinarily cynical and destructive things the United States did to make possible that war, should we really now forget all about that history and pretend the United States is this country with a halo over its head? I think that would be a very foolish thing to do. But I think in order to basically accept what you're saying, we would have to do that. All right? We'd also have to basically accept that or assume that somehow magically the intervention will be successful and that Iraq was a mere aberration, Libya was a mere aberration, and so on. You know, based upon those considerations, I would say the best thing to do is uphold the idea of non-intervention. Not because non-intervention is great, it's not great, but intervention often results in worse conditions, and manifestly worse conditions, I would say.
So I would say this. I mean, obviously, when you deal with the first two legal rights, the right of sovereigns to control their country, sovereignty, and then the right of self-defense, those are recognized. And so to the extent people go to war because it's a matter of self-defense, I don't think there's any doubt that that's legitimate under the UN Charter. The so-called right to protect, or the obligation to protect, which is the human rights issue, I'm not sure there's a right involved here in the sense of a legal right to do it. I think we're talking about, is there an obligation under some circumstances? And there may be an obligation, but it would be balanced by these other considerations I've talked about, the practical ones. You don't want to make things worse. You want to make sure you have a clear idea of what you want to achieve and where you stop, at what point you say we're done, we've reached the end. And you want to make sure you have the ability to execute on those things in international support. So with that, to me, that's not so much a question of rights in the sense of you can do it or not do it. It's a suggestion of moral obligation tempered by prudence and practicality, and the fact that some weight has to be given to sovereignty and some weight has to be given to the right of self-defense, and where they enter into it, they kind of affect the balance. Finally, on the issue of sovereignty, I would say this. I know that over the last 30 or 40 years, certainly since 1990, the Russians have been very adamant on the issue of sovereignty. And for example, when it comes to the internet, they're very interested in making sure that each sovereign has control over the internet in their own country. The Chinese do that by having a great firewall where they basically try to wall off China from the internet. They have the power to do that. Whether we would endorse that extension of sovereignty, I think, is debatable and probably belongs in another debate. But that can often be an excuse for countries that have dictatorships or tyrannies to basically have a free hand in oppressing their population. And while there may be times we have to accept that and acquiesce in it because of the practical considerations I've mentioned, that's hardly anything to be patting ourselves on the back about. And you always have to balance against these practical considerations, how bad does it have to get before your sense of morality and human decency says, we've got to do something about this. And then what you do depends upon all these other things I've said. One final thing let me just comment on. The professor mentioned sanctions and how sanctions can often wind up hurting the people you're trying to help. And I do think that's true. We saw that somewhat in Iraq as well. I think what we've got to get better about when we use sanctions is to target them against the people who are actually the beneficiaries of the misconduct that's going on. And one of the things I think we've learned in the last few years is often the people who are carrying out the worst excesses are hiding their money in various parts of the world or buying real estate in London or doing, having bank accounts in Panama. And if we can find, target, and sanction those kinds of activities, that actually can have more impact than an admittedly overly broad general sanction that can be a problem. So there are times when you have to be calibrating, even with respect to nonviolent means of intervening in an ongoing crisis.
That was Michael Chertoff, and before him, David Gibbs, in a debate on humanitarian intervention. They spoke in March 2019 at Oxford University in the United Kingdom. Michael Chertoff was former Secretary of Homeland Security during the presidency of George W. Bush and co-author of the USA Patriot Act. David Gibbs is professor of history at the University of Arizona. He has published widely on international affairs. He's the author of First Do No Harm. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. Now in its 34th year, we are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. Every week, we feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as David Swanson, Dar Jamail, Winona LaDuc, Nader Hashmi, Bill McKibben, and Nancy McLean. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.